Welcome, everybody, back here at Veil of Sound, regular interview Sunday, and I'm very, very happy to have somebody here from a label that I love dearly with all my heart, Pelagic Records in Berlin. Everybody out there, you might have heard that we're having a huge fest this year for the celebration of our anniversary. And we will try to come up with an idea of how to celebrate that on our own. And I hope that when the show is running, at some point we'll have an after party or something like that. And I hope that this guy here will do the music to it. So we have Mirza from Arms and Sleepers here with us. So thanks for joining the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Really a pleasure. And it's also a pleasure because I don't know how it comes, but the Veil of Sound is expanding our musical palette, so you're the next electronic artist that we're featuring. My goodness, not only the six string stuff. It's really cool to have somebody here on the show whose music is not mainly based on riffs and drums and a normal rhythm section.
Although I do all those things myself too.
But with Arms and Sleepers, I guess that the basis of the music is electronic, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely electronic. But, you know, we've also gotten thrown into the post-rock world early on because we had some guitars on our albums. But yes, the foundation of the group was for sure based in using a computer to create music.
And that is also, I hope, at least I hope that I'm not mistaken completely, but that is also how you write the stuff, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I play the piano my whole life. My mom's a piano teacher, so I started piano at a very young age. So I do still compose for side projects. I have, you know, music that I just write on the piano. And sometimes for Arms and Sleepers, I'm also just, you know, dabbling on the piano or on a keyboard, and that's how it starts. But I also, as much as it is electronic music, I'm not like very versed in in technology. So I don't consider myself like a maestro of any kind when it comes to technology and computers. I just view myself as a composer, and you know, whatever you put in front of me, whether it's a computer with a MIDI keyboard or a one string guitar, I think I can write something. And that's what I take the most pride in, I guess. It so happens that, you know, being one person, things are easier to do with a computer.
Can imagine that. And now we also should mention that Arms and Sleepers initially was a two-person project, if I remember correctly, right? And now for a few years,
it was
only
two people.
You, right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's accurate. It was Max, the other guy, and I started Arms and Sleepers in 2006. So we were a two-piece. We toured as a two-piece. Sometimes we would have live musicians. And then about 8 years ago, 7 years ago, Max kind of really stepped out, just because he's more interested in other things. He's a professor of philosophy, of ethics. So he's more in academia. And so there was no time for music. So I just sort of carry the project by myself. But it started with two people, and it was very much a project that came from two people's souls. But now that it's just me, it's, you know, it's just what I feel and what I want to do.
Yeah. And still, however, of course, on the record, we also have a few features. I mean, like, there are some vocalists who do stuff. And so that is also something that we should not forget. It's never just you. It's never just Mirza. No. It is like you have, I don't know how to pronounce it, Yeye. The record, and you have some other singers as well. How do these collaborations then come across? Do you directly look for those people, or?
Yes, usually I'm sort of initiating the contact and the conversation. For sure, it's never just me. For one, I don't mix my own albums, so somebody else is always mixing the albums. And for electronic music, that's a huge thing because it can change a lot of things. So I've definitely collaborated with other producers and mixing engineers. You know, all the compositional ideas start with me, but the final product is very much goes through several hands. And then of course the guest collaborators, like on the latest album or the new album, vocalists, are people who I've collaborated with before, who I asked to contribute to the record, because I never really, I feel like it's always nicer to have other people's perspective and ideas. I prefer to be with Max, to be a duo, because it was always nice to, you know, to get pushback, to get criticized, to say, no, this sucks, or to be inspired by the other person's ideas. I think that's also huge in any kind of art form. I think inspiration from someone else doing something that you would never think to do is really important to me. And that's the case with these singers or collaborators that I invite to be on the album. You know, I give them sort of freedom to do whatever they want. And then, you know, usually it's very inspiring what they do, and it makes the song much better. And it's not just singers on the new album. There's also a live drummer who does live drums in three songs. And he's also my live touring drummer, who he has been on many Arm and Sleepers tours in the past. So yeah, there's definitely a bunch of people involved.
I guess that is also important to you in the sense of not brooding on the record on your own, because feedback is important.
Yeah, definitely feedback is important. I mean, I'm very self-critical, but I also don't really care what anyone thinks to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care to make music to satisfy somebody else. I mm-hmm. make music myself first and foremost. I have a certain kind of vision, not to sound too pretentious, but like, you know, I have an idea of how I want to translate my feelings and emotions into music. And it's first and foremost, it's therapy for myself. That's why I really mm-hmm. do music. You know, I'm lucky that I can also live from it. That's an extra bonus. But the starting point is really that music helps me get through shitty times. And we all have shitty times and we all deal with it in different ways. For me, it just happens to be music. So I don't really, you know, at some foundational level, I don't really care what anyone thinks, because if it works for me and makes me feel something, then mm-hmm. it's good. But at the same time, I'm very self-critical, and lots of stuff gets cut before it makes an album or a release. And sometimes having someone else that is a collaborator that's contributing just change the vibe a bit and make it a little bit more fresh and exciting is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, still, even if you have somebody giving you feedback, of course, he or she will not be able to shift the song from abysmal, like world denying sounds all of a sudden to Club Tropicana, right? You know, yeah, exactly. That's just not possible, right?
Right. Yeah.
You've already hinted at it. Music also has some kind of release for you. Mm-hmm. And here we have to talk about the past 2 years, I guess, and also about your personal story. And I hope you don't mind me going a little bit into that.
No, not at all.
I know that you are a child of refugees, or you yourself also. Mm-hmm. You yourself fled from war-torn Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
What or how much memory do you still have of Bosnia-Herzegovina? How old were you when you left?
Sure, yeah. I was 9 years old when I left. So I was born in 1983, left in 1992 when the war started in the Balkans. I have a lot of memories from that time. I think a lot of... Well, they say that your first 10 years of life are the most important things that you deal with for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's like the first 10 years of life is your memory, and then the rest of your life, you're processing those experiences and memories in some ways. So for me, that's really true, especially because of what happened, of course. But, you know, especially with the new album, but most of the music I make is usually kind of a way of dealing with the past. I don't spend every day thinking about the past, but I'm also not ashamed to admit that I do think about the past regularly. I think it's just kind of a natural human thing. And it's not all rosy and shiny. Obviously, there's bad and good things from the past. And it's distorted. Memories, of course, distorted. But yeah, I remember a lot, of course, because it was traumatic. It was kind of, I sort of became an adult at a young age. You know, I learned what death is at a young age and what, you know, kind of evil is in some way, what it means to be poor and without a home, and, you know, to be like in the middle of nowhere with a suitcase and one parent, and that's it. So, you know, fear. I think fear, of course, then drives you, can drive you to good places or bad places or a mix of both. I think I've been to both. But, you know, I think I'm lucky that I discovered that music can be a way to positively deal with it, and sort of process it in a way that's maybe a little bit more mentally good for me, for my mental health. But yeah, I was 9 when I left Bosnia. We were refugees for several years until we made it to the US in 1996. We traveled in Africa, Northern Africa, and Europe, just as refugees until the US, and then we started a new life there.
So one question that of course strikes me is, where in Bosnia did you live? Did you live in an urban area? Did you live in like the countryside?
Sorry, can you say that again? I didn't.
Where in Bosnia did you live? Did you live in a city like Sarajevo or Mostar or others?
Yeah, I was born in Mostar.
Or did you live out of the country?
I was born in Mostar. So the city with the old bridge.
Yeah. How do you feel, by then, like, just question about like the culture of like remembering things. How do you feel about the reconstruction of a bridge? Is that something that, in your opinion, was 100% necessary, or do you say like,
Yeah, I think it was necessary. Right, sure. I do think it was necessary because it really is the like heart and the pulse of the city. The city is still very divided and is not in a good place at all. You know, for people who know a little bit about the history of Bosnia and this region, you know, they you know, it's like it's a place that's divided between Serbs, Croats, and Bosnian Muslims. I'm originally Bosnian Muslim. Not much to do with religion. I'm atheist, but you know, those are my roots.
Yeah.
And so the city of Mostar, where I'm from, is a city divided between Croats and Muslims. And still even today, it's very much divided. The bridge is like at least the first symbolic step towards some kind of future hope for a better, you know, healthier time. It's not there yet, but I think it was the necessary first step. Of course, it's a shame that the original was destroyed. It survived both World War I and World War II.
Yeah.
And then it was destroyed. But, you know, that's war. And people are also kind of, they are programmed to look to the future and to move on. That doesn't mean to forget, but you do need to move on. Otherwise, we just don't survive as a civilization, right?
Yeah,
so I think this was a first step towards some kind of like future better health.
You've spoken about remembering that you were moving around a lot until you came to the US. Did that also shape your disposition to moving and traveling? Because I know you live in Berlin, but you also travel a lot. For example, transparency, when we record this, tomorrow, Mirza, you're going to be leaving for New York again. So is that also some kind of inner disposition, you know, like moving?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I just turned 40 last year and I didn't really feel settled anywhere and like I'm at home until I moved to Berlin. So most of my 20s and 30s, I spent on tour, living at random Airbnbs, moving month to month, living out of a suitcase, basically, but like really living out of a suitcase. And I think that's because that's kind of what I've known most of my life. And especially in those formative childhood years when you really kind of learn about the world through whatever is in front of you. So for me, it was always moving, living out of a suitcase, being uncertain where you're going to be next month or next year. It's, you know, it's not a great thing to not feel at home anywhere. It's not necessarily a great thing to feel most at home on an airplane or an airport, which is how I feel. But, you know, there's also something about just accepting what your destiny is or what your past is and kind of trying to find some kind of balance. And I think I've finally found a balance living in Berlin. It's the first place since my childhood that I'm happy to call home. And I haven't felt that in the US, where I've lived most of my life, just because, I don't know, I think I feel more European. And so I didn't really click there. And so now in Berlin, I feel like really at home and comfortable. And still, I get to travel and tour, but maybe a little bit more on my own terms, which at this age is nice. But yeah, it was, you know, a 30-year process to get here in some ways. But, you know, everyone has a different journey, and that was mine.
Of course. Do you, now that you have found that home in Berlin, do you now feel as if you are processing the past more directly?
Yeah, I would say that's accurate. In some ways, I think having a home base where I'm comfortable and feeling safe and where I can be vulnerable as a human, I think is allowing me to maybe go a little bit deeper, because I'm not always on the go, on the run, or not as much as before. So yeah, I definitely feel like that. And the new album especially was born out of this kind of, like, I isolated myself in the apartment here last winter for a few months and wrote this record. And the record was inspired by a bunch of things, including the war in Ukraine, but all kind of relating to, you know, my own past and where it all started for me. And it was, you know, a really profound, for me personally, way to kind of deal with some unexplored things in my past, and put it out through music. And I think that was thanks to having a safe space here in Berlin.
Would you agree to the sentence, or would you agree to the notion that, you know, one can only be at ease and open towards yourself within the realms of your home, of your own fortress, so to speak?
I really think so. I feel like in the last two decades, I was like, oh, I don't need a home. I can live anywhere. I can work from anywhere. And I did. And it was fine. But
which is also true in your case, right?
You know? Yes. In my case, yes. But I do really feel home is so important. Those four walls, like you say, a fortress where you can really be yourself. I think it all comes down to being vulnerable. I think, you know, in our society, being vulnerable is not a positive thing, because then you're considered weak or blah, blah, blah. But I think for me, allowing myself to be vulnerable and fragile is super important to then build something healthy and strong going forward. And it starts with a home, as you say.
You have mentioned the war in the Ukraine, and that is something that really impressed me when I heard about it. So last year you did a tour of the Ukraine. So how was that tour within a war-torn country?
So I missed the first bit of the
sentence. Okay, no problem. So last year when I heard it, I was really impressed that you did a tour in the Ukraine last year.
Yep.
How was it to tour a country that is torn at war?
Yeah, sure. I've been going to Ukraine almost every year since 2011. So it's a place that I've toured a lot and where I've seen and experienced most support for my music, one of the places. And so I've always felt very close to Ukraine and touring there and the audiences there and the people that I've met there. And I've seen a lot of parts of Ukraine that maybe not many people would go to, for foreigners or tourists. And I went there, you know, during the first invasion in 2014, in the summer of 2014, I went to some parts in eastern Ukraine, and the roads were already closed and there were tanks and protests, etc. So I already had a little bit of like a taste of, you know, being there during kind of difficult times. And this time I really wanted to go back and play free concerts. You know, I didn't want people to pay any tickets, and I didn't want to force people to donate to anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't want it to be like, come and like, I just wanted people that if they have no money and they don't want to pay for anything, I just wanted them to be able to show up and listen to music, and that's it. So it was a completely self-funded tour, and it was just my way of kind of returning, you know, the favor of all the support that I've seen there over the last decade. And of course, being emotionally attached to it because it's very similar to what happened in Bosnia. You know, we're same type of people. We're Slavs. We speak a language that's, you know, in some ways similar. And we have kind of a shared general history. I think that's why my music has resonated a lot in Eastern Europe, because there's, I think, some kind of dark melancholy in there that resonates with people there. So yeah, I really wanted to go back as soon as I could, which I did last October. And it was, yeah, it was surreal. I was lucky that nothing bad happened while I was there. I wasn't there for that long. I was there for about 5 days, but it definitely felt like going to like an alternate universe a little bit. But at the same time, everything also felt kind of normal like it was before. So that was also strange. It was strange that you knew there was this threat of death and suffering around the corner, but you're just kind of driving in a van and going to the next show like I did in the past. And while I was in Ukraine, you know, there was a brutal attack in Eastern Ukraine that killed, you know, 50, 60 people. So, you know, there was tragedy happening while I was there. I just didn't, you know, experience it firsthand, which was lucky for me. But we also, you know, I had a whole Ukrainian crew.
I lost you for a second when you spoke about your Ukrainian crew.
Yeah, the Ukrainian crew that was with me also took me to some places like Irpin outside of Kiev, to sort of show me some of the destruction that happened. So it wasn't just about going to a club and playing a show. We did also other things. And we were also filming the whole experience because we want to make it into a little documentary at some point. But yeah, it was surreal. It was sort of easy and at the same time tense. And I think this is kind of like the first single that I released called It's Easy. It's kind of like, I don't know. It's like life goes on. People need to survive. And the way to survive is to keep your sanity through things like comedy or going to a concert or, you know, socializing with your friends, no matter whether there's bombs around or not.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the threat of death is it's a real thing. And I know what that is like because I experienced that fear as a kid. So I knew that what the threat is like and what it is to live in this fear of rockets flying above you. But yeah, it was strange to be there as an adult who now lives a normal life in the West, who was very fortunate and privileged. Because I can leave Ukraine anytime I want, but, you know, guys can't. Men can't. So, you know, I was aware of my privilege. I was aware that I was choosing to be there and that I can leave at any time. But I was also glad to, you know, give a little bit of, I don't want to say joy, but like a little bit of like a break from the daily sort of fears that people have. And that's the feedback that I received from people that came to the show, that it was kind of, it wasn't that they were like, happy or sad, just that they were kind of there to take a break from the reality.
Yeah, it gives back that little bit of sanity, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So you went there in October and you came back and started writing the new record. Now in hindsight.
Actually, no. That was this last October, but the album was already finished before that.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, the first single came out a month after I came back from Ukraine, but the album was written in the, you know, past winter.
Ah, like 2022, 23. Ah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Because then the next question would have been, and I guess that even though it's hypothetical, do you think the record would sound the same as it does now if you had written it 12 months later after visiting the Ukraine?
No, I don't think so. I think the same kind of emotions that I was dealing with myself, it was sort of the same kind of time period. Because when I started writing the record last winter, was after I also went back to Bosnia. I know, sorry, that was this year as well. It was after the war in Ukraine had started. I saw this film Belfast, and that was early 2022, and that sort of happened at the same time and sort of formed the roots of the album. And then at the same time, I finally got my visa for Germany, so I felt like I was permanently here and back in Europe, which was kind of like my lifelong goal of this immigrant that left European soil. So there was that, and I was about to turn 40, so like ending sort of the first half of my life, which a lot of it was like, you know, informed by trauma and sort of being this nomad. So it was that, and I was getting to this point, which was last September, of the 30th kind of commemoration of my father's death. So just after I went back to Bosnia for that, then I went to Ukraine. So it was all this whole 12-month period. There was just kind of like a lot going on emotionally for me. So I think the record, whether it was written at the beginning of that period or at the end, would have been kind of the same.
You say that your father died 30 years ago. Did he die in the war?
Yeah, he died in the war. He was a dentist and sort of was helping out, you know, anybody who had any kind of doctor medical background was helping out. And yeah, he was just waiting for water with a bunch of other people, and a rocket fell nearby and him and other people were killed, which is usually how people get killed in, you know, cities that are like sort of surrounded by an army who's like shelling, and they usually they're shelling meeting points, like where you meet for water.
Yeah. Does Mostar also have some kind of highly individual memory, like the roses in Sarajevo?
As what in Sarajevo? Sorry.
Like in Sarajevo, you have these red hard plastic things ground where like a bomb flew in, like the roses of Sarajevo.
Yes.
Does Mostar have something similar?
No, we don't have anything like that. We only have some things around the old bridge that say "Never Forget" on the stone, but nothing like that. That's throughout the city. Sarajevo has always been a little bit more advanced. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit more of a European kind of like, it's a center, you know, it's a cultural center. Mostar is a little bit more provincial.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think like when I look at those roses in Sarajevo, for everybody who has never been to Sarajevo, first of all, go there. I think it's a really cool town. Also visit Mostar. I've been there as well, and I really enjoyed the vibe of the city. So if you ever come to Sarajevo, you will see lots of like hard plastic things in a wall, on the ground, somewhere, wherever. And it's usually not just one little spot, but it's a lot of dots. Like there is a center and there are little red dots next to it. Those are the roses of Sarajevo, which are there wherever a bomb killed a person. Yeah. And just like Mirza said, very often those bombs were not directed at military operations or stations. They were basically sent wherever there was a gathering of people. So that is something that Sarajevo did. And I also think that it was like a necessity for them to do, because the roads otherwise would have been like even shittier than they were when I was last there. But you've spoken about that movie, Belfast.
Yeah.
And I think that is a very, very interesting thing that you mentioned that movie, and also that city indirectly, of course. We're talking of a city of trenches. You know, if I remember correctly, there's like a dozen walls within Belfast. Sarajevo, Mostar, all of Bosnia-Herzegovina also was a country of trenches. And now you've visited the Ukraine. How do you feel about like things like that, like trenches, like the place where it really divides people? Yeah. Do you feel at ease when you're close to something like that, or when you watch something about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's something that I've always been interested in because, of course, of my past. I went to school and studied this. I studied European history and politics. I studied nationalism and ethnic conflicts, ethnic religious conflicts. Of course, Northern Ireland had a lot of common things with Bosnia. Those were the sort of two battlegrounds in Europe in the 90s of, you know, terrible stuff happening. But yeah, so So watching the movie obviously resonated with me a lot, especially seeing it from the eyes of a child who then has to, you know, leave his community, his home, his family behind, and go into the unknown future. I think, you know, when you come from something that is kind of traumatic and tragic, it's always sort of at the root of your being and your identity. That doesn't mean you can't do other things in life, but I think I will always be interested and horrified by divisions like this that lead to death and suffering. And, you know, I'm not very optimistic that that'll ever get solved. I think it's a cycle that just keeps going for whatever reasons. There's many reasons, of course, but yeah, definitely something about these divisions based on things that to me make no sense, especially being an atheist. You know, many of these conflicts have to do with religion and religious differences, and that that's going on, of course, in Israel and Palestine right now. And that day, actually, of the Hamas attack was when I was in Kiev playing a show. So it was really like symbolic, like just like one thing is here and it's like, okay, now it seems a little bit peaceful in Kiev, and there's another thing starting somewhere else, and it's just like you can't get away from it. Of course, for us, it feels very traumatic because it's after the pandemic and it just feels like we're spiraling. but yeah, I think I will always be confused how religious and ethnic differences can make people hate each other so much that neighbors and people that otherwise have so much in common, you know, in the case of where I'm from, same language, same food, you know, everything, you know, we look the same. We do,
yeah, you know, so similar same traditions, jokes. You know?
Yeah. And yet we choose the one thing that is different between us to then go and completely ruin a couple of generations, a country, a region that otherwise has so much to offer, you know, beautiful mountains and sea and healthy people and great food. And, you know, it's, there's a lot, you know, this could have been a very strong country, like economic power in Europe today, but we chose to destroy because of these little differences. So that'll always fascinate me, whether it's, you know, Northern Ireland or Bosnia or Ukraine or Israel and Palestine. It's just, it'll always fascinate me that people can get to the point of such horrendous, you know, murder, tragedy, suffering.
Yeah, it's crazy how the human mind works, right?
Yeah.
Interestingly, you also divided your new record basically into four parts, I would say, like,
yep,
for emotions and feelings. We have innocence, melancholy, rupture, and reflection. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, funnily, they are similar to the four stages of grief, right? But, you know, reflection. Do you think that at this moment you, when it comes to former Yugoslavia, are at a point of reflection, or is it still like a ruptured wound, a melancholy that doesn't go away? Or is it a little bit of all of it?
Yeah. It's definitely transitioning into reflection. It's not 100% there, I would say. But yeah, I think I have outbursts of anger and sadness, mm-hmm, which would kind of be a rupture, but more, a little bit more controlled and sane than when I was a younger person, which makes sense. But yeah, sort of heading towards reflection, but not quite there 100%. You know, I made my short documentary film a couple of years ago, which was also kind of about music and healing, and that making that was also kind of like a step towards being in this reflective mode, rather than like angry and, you know, sort of like irrational mode a little bit. But yeah, I think, like you say, there's always a little bit of everything throughout your life, and you just sort of learn how to deal with it in a better way.
Yeah, something that lacks in that in that quartet, I think, and that is something that will never exist for somebody with your history, is suture. It's never closed. Then when you went to the Ukraine last year, also in 2014 already, how opening for the wounds was it?
Yeah, I think the most of the opening of the wounds was when the war started and when I started hearing, or when the second invasion started in February 2022, and when I was hearing from friends in Ukraine who were going to the front lines. And especially from friends who were fathers who had children. Because then I was thinking like, wow, you get killed and I totally can see what's going to happen to this kid. It's like going to be...
Because
just like, this kid maybe will write music in 20 years to deal with it, or poetry, or they'll become a doctor or something. Like, you know, because I know a lot of people from Bosnia who, you know, are all over the place, who've lost parents or family members, and, you know, their way of dealing with this to like kind of just be a, do something for the world. In a way. So I was just thinking about, I was really thinking a lot about children, and especially children of people that I know. And I was in touch with a bunch of people who I told, like, very directly, like, I think you should stay alive. And like, if you can avoid the front lines, I know you want to defend your country, and I know it's the right thing to do and an honorable thing to do, but I think the future of your country will depend a lot on the next generation. And for that generation to be sane, they're going to need their parents.
Yeah.
So in my way, I was sort of like going back and reprocessing how I felt, because I also felt this anger, and, you know, this is the rupture part of things. You know, I've felt this lifelong anger of losing a parent for stupid reasons. I mean, I don't know why, you know, I don't know why anybody was killed in this war. Today, Serbia and Bosnia are both poor and, you know, don't have a lot of prospects. So nobody won. I felt a lot of anger at losing a parent, and I feel like I've really missed having that second parent in my life. And it's something you have only one chance in life to do, right? There's no like replacement there. So,
and that's there's no second try.
Yeah, there's no second try. And sometimes that's like just like, it's like, oh, it's okay. It's like just not okay. It's just like shitty, and you just feel shitty. And that's it. You can just hit the bottom. And so I was just thinking of all these kids that might and will experience the same kind of feelings. And that really made me super, super sad initially. And then that turned into like, okay, how can I help? And then I sort of full-time volunteered for a bit with the Ukraine stuff. But then I didn't let myself process it properly. So then after being really busy with volunteering, I sort of then hit like kind of depressive mode in a way, because I had, you know, I didn't give myself the space to process it. So I think that was the most kind of unsettling time for me, is when it finally started and it was kind of like reliving my past in some ways.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, there are these moments when you just hit rock bottom, and for everybody out there, if you hit rock bottom and you feel as if there is no way up again, and get yourself some help, please. But for all those who feel as if, you know, there is something left and you just need a little bit of time, then give yourself that time. Because time doesn't heal all wounds, no? But it can heal a lot of wounds.
For sure. Absolutely.
And it's also interesting that you say, you know, like life goes on and life has to go on. And we have to keep that little bit of sanity in our head. Mm-hmm. And I also think that music is one of the most effective ways for that.
Yep.
Would you then be okay if we said like, okay, this record, the new record, What Tomorrow Brings, is like your next bit of not volunteering, but giving something to hold on to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the title is in some ways positive. I think, you know, the broad stroke is that there is a tomorrow and you just kind of roll with it. there's always going to be more fortunate, less fortunate people. But I think the only thing you can do is control your destiny in some ways. You can control your, you know, how much you help yourself with your mental health, how much time, like you say, you take for yourself, how focused you are on being a better person yourself, mm-hmm. and just a more honest person to you, to yourself.
And to this your environment, of course.
Yes. And so this is kind of what I've learned over the years. I didn't always know this. I didn't always do a good job at this. You know, it's still a process. I'm not there yet. But, you know, it's about growing until you leave the earth. I mean, mm-hmm. what else can you do? Just sit and stare and be depressed all the time? No. But, you know, I really always say, like, it's okay to feel sad and to admit it. And it's okay to seek help. It's okay to not always be stubborn. And sometimes it is okay to also be stubborn and know what you want and just go with your vision. But, you know, I think it's never black and white. And so I think this album is kind of very much not black and white. It's like really like every side is very different musically. And I think emotionally as well. Because that's kind of life. It's like sort of confusing and abstract. Yeah. And then the idea, sort of kind of a broad idea, being that there is going to be a tomorrow, just roll with it, take whatever lessons you can, and just do the best you can for yourself. And hopefully that's enough.
It's also the way that, you know, however bad this day is, tomorrow might be as bad, and the mm-hmm. day after tomorrow might also be as bad, but there will be a day after today that might have a little silver lining. And when we come to silver linings and color, I have to ask that about the cover, because the cover of a record is dark.
Mm. Yeah.
But at the same time, it has a lot of color because it has these lines and everything on it. Is that your way of like showing, okay, there is not only black, there is more?
I mean,
or is that just too much interpretation?
I don't know. I didn't make the artwork, and so I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly what the person that made the artwork was thinking. But this person, Carl, who's a close friend, and I had a lot of discussions of what the album is about, just like we've discussed just now. You know, he also watched the Belfast movie carefully. And so there was a lot of research and observation and listening to the album. And then that was sort of what he came up with, after all that. And somehow it just, hit a nerve for me, and it was exactly kind of, it just matched whatever I was feeling, through the music. So, but yeah, the way that you describe it certainly makes sense. I think I like darker stuff in general. But you know, the inside of the vinyl of the gatefold is actually completely white, yeah. And the outside is black. So that I really like this contrast, because you know, I'm talking a lot about the gray in the strange abstract life that we have. But you know, at one end of the gray is black and the other is white, and so it's kind of everything in between in some way, I guess.
And if I remember correctly, any art teacher who's listening to this, and if I'm wrong, please write it down in the comments. But if I remember correctly, gray is the only color which is not being mixable without two colors that are no color, you know, white and black.
Hmm.
You know, all other colors can be reproduced using normal colors.
Right, right.
Gray needs those two colors that are no color.
That's a perfect poetic little interpretation there. I love it. I'm going to use that for next interview.
Man, please say, oh, where is this very cool guy, you know, working at
Yeah,
the
Villa Sound? I'll make sure to credit you, yeah.
Are you still going to have an interview today before you leave tomorrow?
No.
Okay, I was like, okay.
You're my only one for today.
That is very interesting. Something that I always struggle with is genres, although, of course, you know, being somewhat of a music journalist, I have to. With your music, I feel it's easy. I think there is a lot of trip hop in there. Is that just my imagination, or did you listen to a fair share of Bristol sound?
I sure did. I think I don't hear it as much as other people do, but the most common feedback is that it's trip hop, which doesn't bother me at all because I love trip hop. I would love to make a more proper trip hop album one day, I guess. But yeah, I certainly hear a lot of elements of trip hop in there. And yes, I certainly grew up listening to a lot of Portishead. I think for me, Portishead, it was one of the sort of key influences. You know, I did listen to other things like Massive Attack and Tricky as well, but those weren't as big for me as Portishead. That sort of jazzy, dark, kind of melancholy, but cool and hip vibe really resonated with me.
So did you already listen to Beth's new single?
I have, but I didn't really, it didn't really resonate with me on the first listen. So I think I will just give the album a full, careful listen when it comes out. You know, the album that she released a while back with somebody, it was like
Rustin Man.
Yeah, that one. That I really love. This album I really love. So yeah, I'll give it a chance, but the first single didn't quite resonate with me as much. Did it with you?
I mean, the voice automatically resonates with me. As soon as I hear Beth Gibbons, I'm like, okay, give me a sofa, turn off all the lights, roll down all the blinds, give me some good headphones, and come back in an hour.
Yeah, she's got a magical voice, that's for sure.
That voice is like a gift of heaven. But I have to say, and I have to admit that with this single, it didn't directly speak to my very core. But the vocals are always great. But I also have to say that that last Portishead record, Third, that also took me a hell of a lot of time to get into that one. And since then, I've grown to love it. But it took a lot of time.
It didn't really resonate with me either, that album. But I also know that, and this happens to like people that listen to my music too, like some people just really love the early stuff and that's it. So I really understand that because sometimes...
I'm very sure you know this song, Immigrant Song, Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Which version do you prefer? The original by Led Zeppelin or the cover by Trent Reznor and Karen O?
Definitely the original, but I love Trent Reznor and I love everything he does pretty much. But the original, because Led Zeppelin.
You just used a phrase a few minutes ago and you said, like, you got to roll with it. And of course, nerds among us, the first thing that comes like, you got to roll with it. Yeah. So, Oasis, Roll With It or Champagne Supernova?
Champagne Supernova. Gosh, I love that song so much. Just puts me in some state that I don't even understand, but that I want to be in. So Champagne Supernova for me.
Would you agree with me that that might be the best track that they have ever written? Because I cannot hear Wonderwall anymore.
I can't agree with you. I think Wonderwall is an incredible song. I love Wonderwall. I think that song is so good.
I'm a sucker
for simple pop songs. That song just the vibe, you know, it's the most simplest chord progression, but just for some reason, the atmosphere and the vibe of it and how it's recorded and executed is just really hits a nerve. And that's why it was so huge. You know, yes, overplayed, which is really annoying, but I have to put that to the side because the overplay thing is like not their fault. But the song in its essence, I feel like is such a good song. Champagne Supernova close second for me, but I gotta roll with
okay, that was a good one. We have spoken about Belfast, and of course, you know, when we talk about Northern Ireland and Ireland in general, music comes to your mind. So I'll give you two famous songs about Northern Ireland, both not by Northern Irish people, I just recognize. Belfast Child by The Simple Minds versus Sunday, Bloody Sunday by You 47. Two.
I like Sunday Bloody Sunday a lot. I don't like U2 at all.
It's interesting. Yeah.
But that song is a pretty heck of a fucking song.
Yeah. It is. I would also have chosen that one. Yeah. Last one, and here you can make some advertisement for your former home country. And I'm not talking about Bosnia Herzegovina, I'm talking about Yugoslavia. You will also notice why. You get two Croatian islands to choose from, and I hope that you can.
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm actually going to a Croatian island in June, so let's see.
Var versus Korčula.
Korčula, 100%.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
Hvar is too touristy, and it's beautiful, but it's too touristy. Feels a little bit more commercial. Korčula feels authentic. The wine, it has that magic that I think Hvar has lost a little bit, but Korčula still has it. And of course, Korčula town I think is so beautiful.
It is, but I have to say that the western tip, where my family and I resided 7 years ago. Uh-huh. It's also wonderful. That is even less touristy.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. This is what is it called? The town there?
Vela Luka, I think.
Yeah, we're. I'm going to be with some friends, like a group of people in Korčula this June, and I think we're going to be in Lombarda, which is of course near Korčula town. But I also like that it has easy access to the peninsula and. At the start of Pelješac Peninsula is also like some of my formative memories because we would my parents would always take me there for oysters and seafood, and so it's like one of the most happiest memories I have from my childhood. It's from that peninsula, and my dad had a sailboat when I was young, so most of my summers were spent in marinas across the Adriatic. So the Adriatic is really kind of close to my heart. Obviously, I have a difficult relationship with Croatia. The Adriatic coast is super close to my heart. That's where I kind of grew up. And one day I would definitely love to own a little piece of property on an island like Korčula. I think it would be wonderful.
Yeah. And without trying to do like something like visitcroatia.com, like tourist agency or something like that.
Yeah.
I have been 3 times in Croatia, but now. And we are always making like plans for like 2 or 3 years of vacancies or not vacancies, vacations, sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And every year I'm trying to sneak in Croatia somewhere into it. And my wife is like, we have already been there 3 times. Oh, I forgot.
It is really beautiful. I think it's really magical there.
It is. It is. So Mirza, despite all the technical problems, thanks for all your time. Thanks for
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you for doing this interview. Wonderful. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Enjoy the rest of your day and have a safe trip tomorrow.
Likewise. And thanks for doing this. I really appreciate the time. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Cool. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks. Take care. Bye.
I will.